I was in Anchorage last week. My daughter had surgery to remove a rod and screws from her leg. I don't really know that I had any expectations for what they were going to take out, but I was stunned when they handed over the hardware. The rod looked like some part off the steering from my snow machine, and the screws looked like something I could use in building my cabin. At any rate, the surgery went well, and she is on the mend towards having a metal-free, healthy leg and foot again. While there, I saw a number of starlings near the Walmart on Benson. You might remember them as having been the topic here a few weeks back. It'd be interesting to know what starling numbers are in Anchorage now, with a couple of decades to multiply. We also saw a cool, resident bird. While eating at Wendy's, on the way back to the airport for our flight out, we saw hundreds and hundreds of a particular songbird, happily eating away on berries on some trees near where we parked to eat. That bird, the Bohemian Waxwing. Welcome to Bristol Bay Field Notes. I'm Terry Fuller, Education Specialist for Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. Waxwings are a highly gregarious songbird that are unique in color and a bit in shape. They remind me of cardinals in that they have a crest like a cardinal, but their color and markings are nothing like cardinals. There are two types of waxwings found on the North American continent, the cedar waxwing and the Bohemian waxwing. Cedar waxwings are pretty common across all of the lower 48 and push a decent ways into Canada, but fall short by a ways of making it to Alaska. The Bohemian waxwing covers the upper 1/4 of the lower 48, the western half of Canada, and a lot of the forested parts of Alaska. They are at times found around Dillingham, so they are a bird that you can reasonably expect to see at some point during the year. Several times a year, normally in November or early December, I'll see flocks of them in the trees outside my office window. Waxwings are about the size of a robin, say 7 inches long and a wingspan of a bit more than a foot, but have a more robust look to their body. When they fluff up to stay warm in the winter, they can look like a round ball of feathers with a head and tail. They have that shaggy crest, like a cardinal, and the wings are broad and pointed. The tail is fairly short and squared off. They have a black mask that goes across the eyes and curves up and across the head, and a black bib under the bill, which is also black. They are grayish-brown overall, with kind of a peach blushing around the mask. The wings have two white rectangular patches and red, wax-like tips on the secondaries, hence the name. The underparts below the tail are a rusty reddish-brown, and the tail is tipped with an easy-to-see yellow bar. Males and females look alike. Bohemian waxwings nest along the edges of forested areas and also in openings in timbered areas near lakes, streams, and marshes. The nest is placed in a tree on a horizontal branch. Both males and females gather materials such as twigs, grasses, mosses, and other types of plant fibers for the building of the nest, but only the female does any actual constructing. She weaves materials together to form a cup that's 6 inches across and 3 inches deep. Building the nest takes up to 5 days. Into this nest, she lays as many as 6 eggs that are gray-blue, with a smattering of black spots. She incubates the eggs for 2 weeks, and the chicks, naked and helpless at birth, remain in the nest close to another 3 weeks. Unlike a lot of other songbird species, waxwings don't defend breeding territories, and they don't often return to the same area to breed. They're just not the territorial sort. It's thought that the possible reason is because they move around so much following their preferred food sources, which we'll get to in a moment. They are monogamous during the breeding season, and their methods leading up to finding a dance partner are interesting. The male fluffs up his body feathers, raises the crest, and pushes his tail down. Once he has a female's attention, he passes her fruit. If she's interested in return, she'll pass the fruit back. And this can happen over a dozen times before mating actually happens. I mentioned we saw a lot of birds. Honestly, it could easily have been in the thousands. They are very social during the winter months and form huge flocks in an effort to find fruit. Waxwings feed mainly on insects and some fruit during the warmer months, but switch over almost entirely to fruit during other parts of the calendar. They pick fruit from trees and shrubs, swallowing whole as they feed. This is what my daughter and I got to watch while eating our own lunches last week. Depending on location and availability, they'll eat virtually any kind of fruit. There are a number of cool and interesting facts about waxwings, beyond how pretty they are and how fun it is to watch a large flock. They are something like gypsies because they move around so much following the food. One waxwing banded in British Columbia was recovered a year later in South Dakota. Another individual flew 280 miles in 11 days. They have an uncanny ability to find fruit just about anywhere. I saw it written in one place that it's almost like they have a GPS tracker for berries. Flocks will show up in remote areas, find an isolated shrub, devour all of the fruit in a matter of minutes, and then move on to the next smorgasbord. Related to food, those red waxy tips for which they're named, those come from the fruit they eat. As the birds get older, the waxy tips get bigger. And one last factoid. The oldest recorded Bohemian waxwing was just shy of 6 years old. Researchers banded it all the way back in 1968 in Saskatchewan and recovered the same bird in 1973. Shifting gears just a bit, with this the first episode of 2020, I'd like to look back at something that turned 20 years old, the Y2K scare. The scary part now, for me, is that we're getting to the point of having functioning adults who don't remember it. Boy, that was a hoot, wasn't it? Let me tell you about my world when it happened. I was 34 years old, living and teaching in Kansas. My oldest daughter was just shy of 3 months old, and my son was a bit over 10 years old. My best friend, a K-State graduate, was living and working in San Diego, and K-State was playing in the Holiday Bowl that year, held in San Diego. On December 29th, Kansas State beat the Washington Huskies 24-20. Why this is relevant is because my buddy bought me a plane ticket to come out and watch the game with him. My return flight was after New Year's. My wife at the time never forgave me for leaving on what could have been the nightmare come true that Y2K could have been. I could have been stranded over 1,000 miles away as our society fell apart completely on that particular January 1st. Of course, that's not what happened, because Y2K failed to materialize. I returned home from my trip, and the world went about the business of moving along under a new year. For those too young to remember, here was the concern, the whole Y2K thing. It revolved around our heavy dependence on computers. There were rumors of a computer bug that was going to lead to a crashing of computers worldwide with catastrophic effects. It was tied to how computers read dates. Computers recognized the coding of 98 as 1998, but it was believed that they would not be able to know that 00 meant 2000, and instead would read it as 1900. The concern with regards to that was that misreading the date would lead to a cascading of computer issues that would send us back to the Stone Age. Those who were both convinced and convicted started making plans well in advance, preparing their lives to be able to move forward without money in banking or any sort of utilities that were computer dependent, which was pretty much everything. People were told to start creating survival kits and to think about shelters to build. This was happening on a level from the individual all the way up to the city level across our country. I was just sharing with one of my colleagues the other day that I remember one teacher I taught with in Kansas back then, Hi Rose, whose husband was in full-scale prep mode. She thought it was a bunch of hooey, and she'd tell us about Leroy doing this or Leroy doing that in preparation in the months leading up to the end of 1999. Thing is, he was far, far from alone. I don't remember what my own preparation was like. I don't think I did anything because I don't remember being convinced anything was actually going to happen. But it sure captured the attention of the nation that year, and now, 20 years later, it's a fading memory. I will say this, though. For those of us across rural Alaska, Y2K had some good lessons, as far as being prepared for times when services might be down. Our winter weather can leave us in a bit of a hole from time to time, and it's not a bad idea to have a fallback plan and enough supplies to get through a few days when it does. Food for thought as we begin another year in earnest. For Field Notes, I'm Terry Fuller. Music from Loon Echo Lake provided courtesy of Solitudes at www.solitudes.com.